From the Cyber Hub bunker and studio, you're tuning in to the Cyber Hub podcast. And now for your host and CISO, James Azar.
Good morning, security gang. Welcome to another episode of the Cyber Hub podcast. We've got a packed show for all of y'all this morning. We've got a lot to cover, so we're going to get right into it. But before we do so, please make sure to subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast listening platform. Also, this evening, the Cyber Kill Chain, the decentralized Cyber Kill Chain article will be dropping on Substack. So go check that out. If you haven't subscribed to our Substack, please make sure to do so now. Now, without further ado, let's go ahead and get this show kicked off this morning with a magnificent double espresso. Coffee cup cheers, y'all. You guys haven't seen me use one of these, right? These are like my secret espresso cups. They're great. Spot on. Let's go ahead and get started with some really important news around Kubernetes. So Kubernetes used in almost every single environment released a patch last month that's now being actively exploited as part of the known vulnerabilities in the open metadata, open source metadata repo that's now under active exploitation since at least the beginning of this month. It's allowing threat actors to launch code execution cyber attacks against unpatched Kubernetes clusters, according to the Microsoft Threat Intel firm. Open metadata is an open source platform. It operates as a management tool as well as a central repo for metadata. In mid-March, researchers published information on five new vulnerabilities: CVE-2024-28255, 28847, 28253, 28848, and 28254. Those affected versions preceding version 1.3.1, according to the Microsoft report. And while many teams missed that advisory, even us, like I actually mined our news to see if we were able to catch it, and we didn't. We missed this one, so I owe y'all an apology. We should have been paying closer attention. The vulnerable Kubernetes workloads, which is exposed to the internet, is getting exploited, according to Yossi Wiseman, a Microsoft researcher. While cyber criminals were engaged in crypto mining, he warns that there's a wide range of nefarious activities an adversary can engage in once they're inside the clusters. In general, once an attacker has control over a workload in the cluster, they can try to leverage this access for lateral movement, both inside the cluster itself or also to other external resources attached to it. Open metadata admins are advised to update, use strong authentication, and reset any default credentials in place. If you thought ransomware had no limits, you were absolutely correct, and rightfully so. The Food and Agriculture ISAC reported 167 ransomware attacks against its industry last year alone. That's the seventh most targeted sector in the country behind manufacturing, financial services, and others. Thus far in the first quarter, the sector has counted 40 ransomware attacks, a slight decrease of the year before. Multiple food companies dealt with cyber incidents last year, including Dahl, Cisco, and Mondelez. The U.S. Department of Agriculture told Recorded Future News last year that it was affected by a ransomware group exploiting exploitation of a popular file transfer tool. Guess which one that is. The director of Food and AG ISAC, Jonathan Braley, which formed in 2022 following a run of attacks on the industry that directly affected food pricing, told Recorded Future News that the sector is in the middle of the pack compared to other critical infrastructure sectors affected by ransomware. But nonetheless, it just shows you kind of the ransomware actors and their approach to, you know, these types of industries. And that's why, you know, when you look at stuff they say and, you know, they try to behave and try to have some sort of moral code. That moral code does not exist. That's why the decentralized kill chain article for me was personal, is because doing this for so long is kind of showing you the fact that the threat actors have no limits at doing this stuff at all. They don't feel bad. It doesn't impact them nearly a bit. And they use it for their advantage. And so there's that, the food and agriculture industry under ransomware attacks. I mean, if you're going to leave one industry off, anything you do would be healthcare and food, right? Because you're humane. But there's that. Cisco released patches for a high-severity integrated management controller vulnerability that has a public exploit code that can let local attackers escalate privileges to root. So the IMC is a baseboard management controller for managing UCS, C-Series rack, and S-Series storage servers via multiple interfaces, including an XML API, web UI, and a command line interface. The vulnerabilities in the CLI of the Cisco Integrated Management Controller that could allow an authenticated local attacker to perform command injection attacks on the underlying OS and elevate privileges to root. Now, important to note there, authenticated, meaning they've got to be able to get credentials and authenticate their way in. MFA helps reduce that authenticated attacker channel, right? I typically get really nervous when I see unauthenticated remote attacker. Authenticated local attacker creates a higher degree of expertise that's needed in order to get there, with having to get through your defense in depth layers, two or three layers deep to get to this position. It's been assigned a CVE 2024-202-905, the security flaws caused by insufficient validation of user-supplied input. And the vulnerability impacts the following Cisco devices running vulnerable IMC versions and default configs: the 5000 series, the Catalyst 8300 series, USCC series racks in standalone mode, and USC E-series servers. All in all, you want to make sure you get those patched up and ready to go. The Fin 7 is targeting large U.S. automakers' employees with a spear phishing email for employees in the IT department to infect systems with the Anik backdoor. According to researchers at BlackBerry, the attack happened late last year and relied off a living off the land binary scripts and libraries. The threat actor focused on targets with high-level privilege, lowering them with links to malicious URL impersonating the legitimate advanced IP scanner tool. BlackBerry attributed the attacks to Fin 7 with a high level of confidence based on the use of the unique PowerShell scripts using the adversary signature PowerTrash obfuscated shellcode invoker that was first seen in the campaign back in 2022. Now, the attack chain itself is a spear phishing email. It's targeting highly privileged employees in IT, and that's not really hard to find. Just go anywhere, put a company name in LinkedIn, then put IT, and then find the people who you think, based on their job title, would have that. Understanding the email layout is the second one, and then advanced IP scanner, kind of using a type squat way in order to get through the mailboxes. And again, it shows you the focus we need to have on email, especially on high privileged users, that you can't just apply a blanket policy across the org, especially in large organizations, because you disrupt business. But then you've got to be able to defend your high value users. This is one of those cases where you go, all right, we should be using more caution with these types of users. And even though you work in IT or in security, doesn't mean you're susceptible, that you're not susceptible to these types of attacks, or you won't fall for them. I know the best of professionals that have clicked on these types of emails in their career at least once or twice and come to regret it. But nonetheless, we're still a target. And just because we do this doesn't mean we're immune to the consequences that come with it. So Fin 7, again, going after that, that's important to note, because that's going to really escalate into other organizations and are going to try to do it in other places. They want to be able to launch this backdoor, and they want to target IT because that's where the recovery starts, right? So your IT typically runs backup and restore. And so if they're able to leverage them, if they're able to get rid of the backups and stop the backups or encrypt the backups or otherwise get a good network topology of what's in play, potentially even looking at a playbook sitting on someone's hard drive, that gives them a whole lot more leverage when they launch a ransomware in negotiating with the organization. So be mindful of that as well. The Kapika, there's currently almost zero public knowledge of the Kapika backdoor beyond a brief description from Microsoft that was published on Valentine's Day. Concerning the discovery of the new backdoor, it calls Knuckle Touch. Microsoft's attributing both of these, the Knuckle Touch backdoor, to C-Shell Blizzard, which is another name for Sandworm. My God, how many names could we potentially give a threat actor? In its own analysis, security firm with secure beliefs, Kapika is a tool of an APT, nation-state group, but it's not sufficiently confident that the group is Sandworm as compared to someone else. I think Microsoft has a higher level of confidence that it is them. They found numerous overlaps between Kapika and Gray Energy to make a strong connection, but not confirm it. And how do you confirm such a thing until something actually happens? Now, both of those operate similarly. It's a dropper component with a backdoor contained within it. Kapika and Great Energy are DLL files that masquerade as extensions to make them appear legitimate. Both DLLs are exported and created by a first ordinal via the run DLL32. Both backdoors use similar custom algorithms to structure data that is sent to their C2 servers. Microsoft and with secure believe the malware has been in use since at least 2022, yet apart from the with secure analysis, little is known about it. Typically, in some of these cases, you'll see these types of malwares delete themselves immediately when they launch a ransomware. So there's no forensic evidence of it, or forensics can't get a hold of an exe file in order to study it, reverse engineer it, identify signature, upload it to VirusTotal, and thus making sure it's unsuccessful. So all of those things kind of play here. This could be something that's being used in the Russia-Ukraine war. Again, that cyber warfare going on between Russia and Ukraine, especially in the last probably 3 to 4 months, has been very, very intense. They've been going at it significantly with a lot of new malware families, a lot of new targets, and a lot of new ways to take advantage of it. Keep your eye. I always say whatever's used in the battlefield will end up in the boardroom and in the company office. So just keep looking at Russia and Ukraine, because that's testing, and then, you know, it's going to go out of date because they're going to have a way to defend on it. They're going to try to monetize it in order to continue to fund their next R&D project. They're going to sell it to cyber criminals, and as such. And that goes to our next story here, where cheap ransomware is being sold for one-time use on dark web forums, allowing inexperienced freelancers to get into cybercrime without even interaction with any affiliates. Researchers at the Sophos found 19 ransomware varieties being offered for sale or advertised as under development on 4 forums from June of last year to February of this year. They compared the tools to junk guns, cheap imported handguns that flooded the U.S. back in the 60s and 70s. The same advantage would apply for would-be criminals in the market for ransomware starter kits. The variety researchers observed range from $20 to half a Bitcoin, or approximately $13,000 at the time it was posted. Bitcoin's obviously at $62,000 today, so that's probably closer to triple the price. But the median average price for one-time use malware, or ransomware, sorry, was $375. Now, these differ as ransomware as a service models because there's no affiliates involved who would expect a cut of any of the profits that come there. Away from the complex infrastructure of modern ransomware, junk gun ransomware allows criminals to get into action cheaply, easily, and independently. They can target small companies or individuals who are unlikely to have any resources to defend themselves, giving them a way to do that. This is significant because it's obviously the cheaper it becomes, the lower the cost of entry becomes, the larger the threat landscape becomes, and the more ways we have to look at in defending of this. And this is significant. Again, the decentralization of cybercrime is leading to these types of stories. An academic project used to gain insights into which nations produce the most cybercrime ranked the usual suspects of Russia, Ukraine, China, and the U.S. at the very top, but also found some relative surprises. Well, I don't know what's surprising about Nigeria at 5. I'm surprised about Romania at 6 and Brazil at 9. I figured Brazil would rank higher, and I figured Romania would rank lower. Nations with high technology levels typically scored fairly high on the World Cybercrime Index, especially if those countries also have state-sponsored threat actors that overlap with cyber criminal groups. Yet other nations dominated in one of the 5 areas, like Nigeria taking the top score for scams. Remember that Nigerian prince? And Romania scoring highly in data and identity theft, according to the university research effort by the academic institutions in the UK, Australia, and France. Cybercrime experts have long associated different countries with different types of cybercrime, Russia with banking and ransomware, China with IP theft and financial crimes. But this is the first time that researchers have been able to compare various countries based on specific attributes and cybercriminal approaches, according to this specific report. Really, really interesting. And again, you can see the top 15. Iran ranked at 11, Moldova at 15, North Korea at 7, the UK at 8, India at 10. So all in all, they've given them score. Obviously, Russia, Ukraine, China, the US, and Nigeria all have pretty high scores there as well. So a way to look at this to understand where your threats come from. This should help you a little bit with IP blocking, with identifying fraud, also helping you identify risk coming from those specific countries, and so much more. The Russian disinformation efforts around the U.S. election have kicked into gear over the last 45 days, according to Microsoft. The operation around the U.S. election has ramped up over the last month and a half after a relatively slow start compared to previous cycles. The operation uses a mix of themes seen in the 2020 campaign, renewed focus on undermining U.S. support for the Ukraine, as well as efforts to turn U.S. citizens against NATO to foster domestic infighting. All in all, the MTAC, the Microsoft Threat Analysis Center, explained in a new report that they're seeing traditional and social media kind of go there. So Russia, for their end, are actually doing that. And they're not only doing it here, they're also doing it in French, Arabic, Finnish, and other languages as part of their campaign to really undermine the support around Ukraine. And so it's no different than that as well. And they'll use, obviously, they've got a whole setup of how they use this propaganda, from video content that could be seeded in social media to global coverage from Russian affiliated outlets that mine SEO, that all of a sudden become ranked in Apple News or Google News or anywhere you get your news RSS feeds. And then social media amplifiers, whether it be bots or grifters that share this stuff, all kind of do that there as well. And in our final news of the day, Armis acquires Silk Security for $150 million transaction. M&A continues. This will expand Armis's capabilities to enable security teams to get a consolidated view of security findings from on-prem devices to code, cloud, and application security tools. Congratulations to both teams there. And again, there we have it. That's it for our show this morning. We'll be back with a whole lot more. Monday it will be my last show before I head up for Passover break. And then we'll have some guest hosts filling in for the rest of the week until I come back. So thank you all for tuning in. Tomorrow, Chris Filone and I will be hanging out here, kind of dropping some stuff at 11 a.m. Eastern. Until then, have a great rest of your day. And most importantly, y'all, stay cyber safe.
We love feedback, so make sure to connect with us on social media and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast listening platform.